This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Video games, Blackberries, are our gadgets objects of convenience or addictions? I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Today on the show, from video gaming to our handheld computers, from children to the upper reaches of middle age, we can't seem to keep our eyes off the small screen. Video games are the fastest growing segment of the entertainment industry. What are the pitfalls behind our fascination with small screen games, the internet, and email? On Reporter's Notebook later on, security in Iraq isn't the only job of our armed forces. The Army Corps of Engineers is working to literally reconstruct much of the country. Not an easy task, given the ongoing violence. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point from PRI. Our main topic today, America's fixation on video games. An estimated 50% of us play, both online and on consoles in our homes. War games, sports games, strategy games. Is this the new release mechanism of our culture? A way for us to play anonymously and endlessly in a virtual world? Or is it part and parcel of our growing list of unhealthy addictions? On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, Warren Olney will examine the status of reconstruction projects in Iraq. The daily focus we seem to hear about is the building up of Iraq's security forces, but we are spending some $21 billion in redeveloping and reconstructing the war-torn country as well. First, this news today. With Palestinian parliamentary elections less than a month away, political movement is underway within the Fatah party. The ruling Fatah had split, Tanzim leader Marwan Barghouti leading a young faction in a breakaway. But the two sides are now reuniting, in part to keep the militant Hamas from gaining strength at the polls come January 25th. Joining us now to discuss this is Dan Efron. He's in Jerusalem, a correspondent based there for Newsweek magazine. Dan Efron, thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure, Dana.
All right. You know what? Let's talk about first is today. It is the deadline, I understand, for the submission of candidates for the elections January 21st. First, is that the obvious and only reason that the Fatah party is now coming back together?
I think it's the reason for the timing of this party coming together. They split off just a couple of weeks ago after primaries in Fatah. I think the thing to remember about this group is that it has been hegemonic in the Palestinian leadership for decades, but it has also grown corrupt in the eyes of most Palestinians. What we're seeing, or we have been seeing for months, is infighting within Fatah among these power brokers who want to make sure they get a big piece of the pie. Now, that led to a division in the party a couple of weeks ago. And that division was very harmful for the party's chances against the Islamic group Hamas in elections next month. There was a lot of internal pressure on both these factions within Fatah to come together, and that's what we saw today.
The Hamas group we know of as a militant group, a violent group. I understand their popularity has been growing. Is that a sentiment widely, thought of within Palestine, or is it really that they're just not so much in favor of Hamas, but want some change in what they're seeing now?
Well, I think the latter is true. Hamas has grown more and more popular, certainly during the last 5 years of the Palestinian uprising. One of the things that makes the group popular is its suicide attacks against Israel. But I think there's also been a counter trend in the last year where Palestinians want some kind of state of calm between the Palestinians and Israel. Despite that, Hamas's popularity ahead of this election is growing, and I think it reflects less you know, less a sentiment of support for militancy on the Palestinian street or for an Islamic party, and more just a rejection of this Fatah group that has been leading the Palestinian Authority since 1994, not very successfully, mostly tainted with corruption and also inefficiency. The Palestinian Authority doesn't work very well for most Palestinians.
But the question is, would you still categorize Hamas as a terrorist group? I mean, I understand that this is the first time they will be allowed to run in parliamentary elections.
Well, I think Israel's opinion and our opinion as Americans as well, the U.S. State Department still categorizes Hamas as a terrorist group because it is involved in attacks on civilians, mainly within the West Bank and Gaza, but also within the borders of Israel. The hope is, certainly among moderate Palestinians and even among Israelis, that the entry of Hamas into the political process, this election that will bring them into parliament, will moderate Hamas, will make them seek their own agenda around the table, around the bargaining table, as opposed to using their bombs and their guns to get it. But I think that it's unclear that will happen. It depends in part on how well Hamas does and then what kind of coalition Fatah and Hamas come up with.
Okay, but they're obviously heading more toward the mainstream. Let's talk a moment about Marwan Barghouti, whom I mentioned before. He's a popular uprising leader. I understand he's in jail. He's been jailed by the Israelis, but he is leading kind of the young faction of the Fatah party, now coming back together. I suppose the youth then will be, a bit heavier at the polls because he's coming back with the Fatah in their favor, yes?
Well, that's right. This is the first time that Fatah actually had primaries inside the party. This was a few weeks ago, and Marwan Barghouti is wildly popular in the West Bank, in Gaza. He's in his 50s. He's considered the young guard because the older guys in the PLO and in Fatah are in their 70s. These are people who are contemporaries of Yasser Arafat.
Mm-hmm.
Barghouti's in prison. He's serving several life terms for his involvement in attacks on Israelis and suicide bombings and so on. And so the Israelis have said he's not going to be released. It's really symbolic, more than anything else, that he's at the top of the list. But it's symbolic of a change in Fatah and an improvement in the standing of this young guard, of the younger Fatah people.
Dan Efron, we thank you so much. Correspondent based in Jerusalem for Newsweek magazine. Be back in just a moment with more of To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
I'm Diana Nyad, back with To the Point. Warren Olney's on vacation this week. Grand Theft Auto, Madden Football, Black Hawk Down, World of Warcraft. Is any of this sounding familiar to you? Probably so. Millions of young people especially are spending hours every day playing video games, and 74% of those who do play say they'd rather play video games than watch television. Adults also can't put their BlackBerries or Trio handheld computers down. We are a nation of addicts when it comes to small-screen games, internet browsing, and email messaging. It doesn't hurt to escape while relaxing through a game of Halo 2, and it's a tremendous convenience to be able to work the web on a portable unit, but when eating and work and conversation and homework and exercise take a back seat to intense focus on the little screen, something is awry. There are pros to our time spent on computers, to be sure, and yet there are reasons to be alarmed at what a priority these games and online activities have become. It's an enormous topic in our culture at the moment, so first we welcome J.C. Hertz to the program, principal of Joystick Nation, Inc., which is a research and design firm that applies principles of games designs to products and services and learning systems. Ms. Hertz, the author of Joystick Nation, How Video Games Ate Our Quarters, Won Our Hearts, and Rewired Our Minds. Also the author of Surfing on the Internet. J.C. Hertz, you certainly know whereof you speak on this topic, don't you?
Yeah, you know, I think I've spent more time than, you know, I would have predicted paying attention to this thing. But, you know, it's a dynamic world, and it's definitely an important factor in the culture. So, you know, it's worth paying attention to.
Well, when you say important factor, I mean, it's a craze. Let's lay out some of the statistics and demographics for us. How many people, what kinds of people? Is it only kids, first of all?
Well, you know, I think the biggest misconception is that this is for kids, because the average game player is 30 years old and has been playing games for 10 years.
Is that right?
And the average person who buys a game is 37 years old. So, you know, the stereotype, and of course there's a lot of sensationalistic stuff out there that's, you know, that 6-year-olds are playing Quake.
Yes.
But if you look at the numbers, actually, the number of gamers that are playing and how old they are, in fact, 19% of gamers now are over 50.
Well, give us a little history when you give those demographics, because we're talking about the 30-somethings and all the way up to 50 in the big numbers. How long ago did this start? I mean, I think it was the 70s when that big game of Pong was out, and you had a console that was, you couldn't even lift it. And you played that tennis ball that would bounce between the, you know,
yeah,
it was so remedial, but that's the first one I remember.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of these things that happened in the late 70s, which really had to do with the fact that computer chips were finally being manufactured in some kind of volume. So people were trying to figure out what to do with them. And originally they were called TV games. And, of course, the technology got more and more sophisticated. And with the entry of Nintendo in the 80s, that's where you saw things really start to take off towards the early 80s and the middle 80s and into the 90s. And it's interesting to note that, you know, everyone talks about violence, and I'm sure we'll get to this later. But as computer games have gotten more popular, the statistics, as opposed to the news media hype stories, that youth violence has actually gone down.
Is that right?
So, you know, there are a lot of interesting and exciting anecdotes out there, but if you look at the data, as video games have gotten more popular, youth violence has gone down.
You know, we are going to attack, so to speak, the violence issue throughout the program today. But tell us about the holidays. What were the big sellers?
Well,
and I know, you know, the Xbox 360 by Microsoft.
Yeah,
what happened there?
This was not a happy time
for
the video game business, because Microsoft had some manufacturing problems. And they didn't manufacture as many Xboxes as the retailers thought they would.
Oh.
So it was supposed to be this sexy thing that they had a shortage, right? Oh, nobody can get one. But what it turned out that because no one could get an Xbox 360, no one was buying games for it either. And then the PlayStation 3 is coming out next year, and a lot of people just decided, you know what? I'm going to wait till next year. So the latest, greatest next year things come out. And so they didn't buy PlayStation 2 games either.
Now, wait, I'm going to get remedial with you, because I'm going to assume that we have tons of listeners out there today who really don't play these games. Many who do, but just don't know what you're talking about when you say Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3. Literally, is it just one game? And
well,
do you subscribe to it? What do you do?
We're all caught up in this merry-go-round of technology, right? Every year a new batch of gizmos comes out, and we have to have this really angst-filled decisions about, you know, do I buy a new cell phone now or wait for the next one?
Right.
So what happens with video game consoles, which is the ones that connect to the TV as opposed to the ones that are computer games,
mm-hmm.
is that there are these console boxes like PlayStation and Xbox. And we've gone through about 5 generations of these consoles, if you count Pong as the first.
Okay.
And then you had Atari, and a lot of people remember Atari, and then the first generation of Nintendo and Sega, and then, you know, the Super Nintendo, and then this batch that included the PlayStation. And then the PlayStation 2 and the Xbox are the cycle that we're in now, which is just ending. So the cycle tends to be 5 years. A box comes out, the developers start developing for it, the games get better and better and better because the programmers get to understand how to program for it. And then towards the end of the cycle, as people start to anticipate the new batch of consoles, they get less enthusiastic about buying games for the old one because they would rather save their money and wait and get the new one.
Of course.
And it's a little bit like, you know, when people were switching from video cassette tapes to DVDs. There was a long period of time when video cassettes were still being sold, but people who were anticipating getting CD players wouldn't buy video cassettes because they they understood that they were about to replace their entire system.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it wasn't economically intelligent.
All right.
Well, that's a good layout of the land. Let's talk to somebody now who is, a joystick aficionado, almost a professional, I'd say. This is Sean Manzano. He's 20-something, avid game player all his youth and now into his 20s. He's also the quality assurance manager for Nova Logic, which is a video game development company and publisher. Nova Logic's products include Delta Force, Black Hawk Down, which I guess is immensely popular, and Joint Operations. Mr. Manzano, thanks for being with us.
Not a problem at all. Glad to be here.
How old are you?
26 years old.
All right. So, you are both in the personal and the business end of video games. Let's talk personally first. When did you start? How heavy were you into it? At what age?
Probably started about the age of 3 to 4 years old.
No way. What were you playing at 3 years old?
3 years old, I was getting into the Atari and ColecoVision systems that were in, and also I was playing PC games with my mother and stepfather on the computer, like the Tandy 800 series computers that were out back then.
And then?
Then going about 6 or 7, got a Nintendo system, started getting interested in that, started getting into the next generation games that came out after that, and my teens started having more experience as far as playing with other people on the computer, going into my late teens, and got into the video game industry in my early 20s. Been in here for about 5 years now.
Well, now, what is your absolute number one favorite game? I mean, I know it changed through the years, but that you were just the most rabid about.
Probably a game that came out in the mid-90s called XCOM UFO Defense, which was done by a British publisher called Microprose. And that was a strategy, like a turn-based strategy game where you intercepted UFOs, investigated them, and developed technology based on alien stuff that you found and captured.
You know, I have to ask you, we just heard from J.C. Hertz that youth violence has actually gone down over the past some years when video games have soared in popularity. So I'm not really talking about that at the moment, but just what is the thrill? I do go by these video arcades and you see kids on their handheld videos. A lot of it has to do with sort of one person shooting them up, intercepting UFOs, or, you're out in a battlefield and you're chasing down some guy. What is the thrill? And are girls, have your girl, counterparts all the way through here been right playing these games with you or no?
Well, it really depends on the genre of game that you're talking about as far as females playing games. As a game developer, you're going to target the demographics that are best for your game. There are games that are almost specifically designed to appeal to women. There are ones that are supposed to be unisex appeal. The super popular Sims, done by Electronic Arts, is one of those games.
I've heard of Sims, and excuse my ignorance, but what is Sims? Because women do like that more than men, right?
It's about a 50-50 split with that.
It's equal. What is it? What's that game like?
That is a game in which you create personalities, like avatars. Give them personality traits like cleanliness and how hardworking they are. Put them into a house which you design. Give them clothes that you pick for them, and kind of watch in on them voyeuristically and supervise them as they go about their daily tasks.
Yeah, it's like reality television on the video screen.
Absolutely. That's a very good analogy for it.
Okay. Well, I keep reading this, this term massive multiplayer online role-playing games, and it actually has an acronym. That's the MMORPG, right?
That's correct.
Give me an education on those.
That's basically a game in which you, instead of being partnered up with artificial intelligence or, a single-player game that's on your console, you're connecting with your computer over the internet, and you are playing to achieve goals along with anywhere from half a dozen all the way up to hundreds of other players that are playing online in the same game servers as you. You're each going to pick an avatar or a character that's going to represent you, and you'll do everything from meet up with other people and have conversations, go out and slay monsters, get treasure. It's like a online version of the games like Dungeons and Dragons that were introduced in the late 70s, early 80s.
So it's a bit more social.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, how many hours a day? Now you're working, but you're still in this business. Just through your young life so far, how many hours a day would you say you've played these games?
On a casual aspect, as opposed to work, some days an hour. Some days I'll go on like an all-day binge, play for an excess of 8 to 12 hours.
Will you really? And do you feel that you have foregone exercise or relationships or dinner conversations for your hobby?
It's really interesting. I have a decent social group that I've managed to maintain through video games, and a lot of the people that I'm playing with when I'm going online and playing games are people that I've met through the game industry, people that I have been friends with and met through more traditional social channels, work, school, acquaintances, and we're using this as more of an activity to something that we could do together as a group, as opposed to going out to a movie or going out and seeing live music or something, which we do in addition to that.
Okay.
For example, last night while I was playing, one of my best friends who just got back from winter break at college and my girlfriend and I were all playing online together, playing a massive multiplayer game called World of Warcraft by Blizzard. And the three of us were all logged in playing together and talking and just enjoying the time together.
Well, the way you present it, it's almost like it's like the new generation's version of sitting down and playing a game of Monopoly together.
Right, and that's a very good analogy for it. I mean,
all right.
I'm still going to be getting together and playing a poker game live and in person with people tonight. I'm a big gamer as far as board gaming too.
Okay,
but it's just another option to be presented to people as opposed to something like Monopoly or that you're playing in person.
All right. Well, thank you for all that, Sean Manzano. Stay with us if you would, and J.C. Hertz. We'll get back to you after our break. And before we go to break, let's bring in Dr. Marissa Hecht-Orzac, who's the director of Computer Addiction Study. It's a center at McLean Hospital, Massachusetts. Assistant clinical professor in psychology at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Orzac, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we will have to take a break in a minute, but just now we've heard, sort of a young person who sounds like he's got a well-rounded life, and, he loves these games, but he does other things. We've heard from J.C. Hertz, who tells us, how widespread, how many millions of people are playing these things. But you have found and dealt with patients on an addictive end of it. Tell us about that a bit.
Well, there's a lot to say about that. I would say that I get at least 4 or 5 messages on my email a day from people who are concerned about their children, their spouses, their significant others playing games.
And is the main complaint that they are giving up so much of the rest of their well-balanced life? Is that the heart of it?
That's a major thing. Their balance is gone. They do not. They're not able to keep themselves on doing things that are expected of them.
Sure. Now, did you have any personal history with any of these games? Do you understand these people when they come in to talk to you as to what the draw is?
Well, I guess I have to go back to my original problem 10 years ago now, and that was I was playing solitaire, and solitaire every time I found myself in another program or something, and I would get frustrated or angry at what I was doing. I switched back to solitaire.
Ah.
And I kept on playing more and more solitaire.
And do you mind if I ask how old you are?
81.
Okay, so we heard from Sean Manzano, who's in his mid-20s, and we're hearing from you at 81, so this isn't just a kid's problem. It's
correct. It is not just a kid's problem. I have had patients and correspondence with people who are well in their 60s.
All right. Well, listen, we have much more to talk about, and I wonder if the three of you would sit tight. We have Professor Peter Vorderer joining us in just a minute, too. Fascinating topic, widespread around the world, I understand. I want to get into the international aspects, too. So we'll be right back in a moment with more of To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. We're discussing our addiction to video games and all kinds of online activities. We don't simply relax to escape our hectic lives or use internet resources to make tasks more convenient. Many of us are unable to tear ourselves away from games and text messaging or any of the things we do on our portable computers. We're speaking at the moment with Dr. Marissa Hecht-Orzac, who is a clinical professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School and directly deals with people addicted to these types of games and It's not just games, is it, Dr. Orszag? I mean, we all have that experience of sitting down to dinner with someone and they cannot just talk to you. They've got to multitask and be checking their messages all the way through dinner.
Unfortunately, you're right. It is not just games. It is many other things. It's a compulsive behavior, really, when people need to check frequently and can't stay with you. And I recently heard about somebody who was sitting at a party, and one of the people was sitting in the corner, and he was checking his email. And I've forgotten the direct circumstance about this, but I just remember that as a case where I thought, yeah, probably shy, or maybe who knows?
Yeah, yeah. But you know, I guess the to play devil's advocate, and I'm going to go back to Sean Manzano in a moment to ask him this question. You know, what's the harm, really? Is it sort of the new phase of our culture? I'm sure we could go back and talk to people, you know, at the turn of the century, the last century, who would say the way, you know, we behaved in the 60s and 70s was, you know, inappropriate in terms of sitting down to a family dinner every night for 2 hours. We no longer do that. We're just moving at a quicker pace. Is there anything wrong, or is that just the evolution of our culture?
It depends on what the losses are, and that's what I usually talk about. I define these as problems where people lose contact with their families. I can't tell you how many people ask me, my child is so bright, and mostly he, spends so much time online and spends so much time playing games that he's neglecting his homework, his grades are falling, and I don't think he's going to get into the college that he wants because of all this happening to him.
Okay,
I mean,
so
that's a typical kind of thing I hear.
Yeah, I hear you. Sean Manzano, come back with us, will you? Sean is in his mid-20s, an avid game player all his young life now. He also works for a company called Nova Logic, which develops video games. Mr. Manzano, you know, you described earlier, if people didn't hear you, that, you know, to you it's a very healthy thing. It's been fun. You played these games with your parents when you were a kid, with your girlfriend now, so it hasn't kept you from doing other things. But surely you know of the addictive side. You must have friends who have just gone overboard, spent their entire college careers playing games.
Absolutely. It is a danger of something that's happening. And really what I see in cases like that are cases in which it was allowed and acceptable when people were growing up, when they were younger, mm-hmm. and it's habits that they take with them when they go into, you know, teenager, 20s, into college and stuff like that. I was very lucky in the case where I had parents who didn't let the video game supervise me so much as they would play along with me, and then when I had other obligations to fulfill, whether I was going to, you know, had to do homework or I had martial arts class in the afternoon or whatever, they assured me that that had to take priority. And they were there to insist that I put everything in the correct context, really.
I see. So you're really painting a picture when you're a kid, when you're 6 years old, you have a lot of free time.
Mm-hmm.
And as you get to be 20 and you're at college, you should be, you know, sort of balancing that time out.
Right. And it was just good habits that were kind of, you know, bred into me as I was growing up, where I was able to self-manage that kind of time.
Okay. J.C. Hertz is with us today as well, the author of Joystick Nation, How Video Games Ate Our Quarters, Won Our Hearts, and Rewired Our Minds. Ms. Hertz, how about the addictive aspect of these games in your book?
I think the most important point to make is that we have to evaluate video games and computer games as media according to the same standards as we do for, say, television. Because what's considered normal in America is to watch 3 hours of television a night.
Mm-hmm.
And when you say, oh, people are playing 20 hours of video games, of computer games a week, God, that's scandalous. But we don't examine the fact that we watch that much television on average in America per capita, every, you know, on a weekly basis.
And I suppose if you can compare it, I mean, so many parents, have been up in arms at how much television their kids watch because you're sitting there in this passive, receptive mode. At least in a video game, it seems to me, you're participating, you're thinking.
That's true. But I think that across the board, we should examine stuff that you do in front of a screen as a category, as a budget for how much time do you want to spend in front of a screen, and then just say whether it's television or it's games or it's, you know, handheld Nintendo or whatever it is, not to give television this privileged place of, well, we do it so much it's invisible, so we're not going to count it, but we're going to worry about video games.
Well, you know, as I said before, there's a statistic running around saying that some three-quarters of people playing these games prefer the games to television all the way around.
And network viewership among young people is actually down. Games is something that network executives worry about a lot.
And by the way, not just television, but where do video games fit in terms of comparing them to the money and the popularity of music, CDs, movies, DVDs, all of that business?
Well, it's interesting because in some ways, games substitute for music, but then the music industry and the video game industry are always trying to find ways to work together, because if you go into a snowboarding game, say a very popular genre, there are always the young, hot, hip record acts that want to get their songs into these games, just as if you have a NASCAR game, there are going to be marketers who want to get their logos into the virtual NASCAR. So it's a little bit complicated. I mean, the music business is really doing dismally, mm-hmm. and I think part of it is that people have other things to do. But, you know, to the point about, you know, the kid in the room playing video games, I think in the 60s you would hear the same thing about, you know, all my kid does is lock himself into his room and play records, and it's ruining his life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the more things change, kind of the more they stay the same.
Let's bring in Peter Vorderer at the moment. Peter's a professor of communication and psychology at the University of Southern California, joint editor with Jennings Bryant of Playing Video Games, Motives and Responses and Consequences, which will come out in just a couple of months. Professor Vorderer, thank you for waiting and joining in.
Sure. Let's
go with this particular topic that J.C. Hertz was just raising now about the antisocial behavior of sitting for hours and hours locked in a room. You should be out in the backyard wrestling with the neighborhood kids.
I agree.
Okay.
See, I think the situation is more complicated. We tend to rate and evaluate things like video games uniquely, positively, or negatively. And the matter of fact is that it's both. You know, you can look at that as a curse and as a blessing, if you want to put it that way. Video games have many, many great potentials, many, many aspects that are positive that can be used in education.
Such as what? Give me an idea of what you might get out of playing a video game that you can transfer to real-life situations.
Well, one thing we are studying now is how you can use video games to make learning happening more efficiently with kids. Obviously, kids are much more interested in playing games than listening to teachers. So more and more teachers incorporate games into their environment. We do that at USC. I know many teachers do it already. And we pick the kids where they are with their interest. And the games are a great challenge to the kids. The kids are excited and try to meet the challenge. And by doing so, you can help them learn a lot what they otherwise wouldn't learn that easily. So there's a great potential.
Okay.
Games are used in the military. They are used for training purposes already. And this will only be more in the future. I have no doubt about that. Most of education will be done with games. If you look into classrooms today, if you look into colleges, you find a great deal of the students sitting behind their laptops. And what they do is they take some notes of the professors. They do some email. They do some games. They do some dating service. They do a couple of things at the same time. And whenever it's interesting enough for them to listen to the professor, they might take, notes. Or they Google what you say, and they say, hey, professor, I've found somebody who says it differently.
So you're saying, as a modern-day professor, when you stand up in one of your communication psychology classes at USC, and all the kids in front of you, most of them have their laptops open, you know very well they're not just sitting there listening raptly, taking notes. They're multitasking in a big way.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't bother you.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I have no way of controlling that. You know, this starts, if you look at the PhD class, every student is sitting behind the laptop and basically works on what we're discussing. Teaching is not, you know, transporting a message from the professor to the student anymore. This also will be the case more and more with undergraduate students who are doing multitasking issues, and of course they also do things for pleasure and for fun. And you know, every modern university, certainly USC, is connected. Every student is connected wirelessly, and there's no way of telling them, you know, you better listen only, or you only take notes, and you can't do a game at the same time. You know, and I also think it would be a mistake to tell them not to do it, because this is something they like to do, they are very good at, they're much better than I am at, and why not use that? And I think the military has understood that, the industry understands that, and more companies understand that, and so everybody is trying to incorporate that and to use it because it's a capacity on the student side. I have no doubt that games have a great future in training and in education. But having said that, this does not mean that, you know, this doesn't come without problems. Of course, games have impact on kids, and many of the impacts are those we don't want to see. And it doesn't make any sense to deny that. We just have to get used to the fact that video games do two things at the same time. For some people, they are a blessing, and for some, they are a curse.
Well, you know,
and sometimes for the same person, they could be a blessing in some situations and a curse in other situations.
Mm-hmm. And when you bring up the curse, I just want to get back. We started at the very beginning of this conversation with the issue of how many of these games are violent, that take place on a battlefield, and
right.
have to do with shooting, et cetera. You know, and so many, you know, through the years, we've had lots of studies done from films and television as to, you know, really watching violence, does it really lead to violent tendencies? Senator Joe Lieberman out of Connecticut, Senator Hillary Clinton out of New York at the moment are proposing federal legislation to get
right.
some stiffer rating systems on video games. Is there any hard and fast information out there as to these war-type video games and how they are affecting kids?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is now enough research that shows that some of the games do have particular impacts. See, this comes back to the point you made earlier about the player being active and not passive as he or she used to be in front of the television. That is true. And being active certainly is better than being passive. At the same time, if you actively shoot somebody in a game, you know, that's probably worse than if you watch somebody else shooting somebody else passively. So, you know, being active is a good thing in one dimension. It can be a bad thing because it also, you know, trains you on doing certain things. It makes you used to it. It makes you less frightened doing things like that.
Well, let's bring Sean Manzano back in. He's our sort of first-person expert today. Mr. Manzano is playing these games all his life, but he's working for a company, Nova Logic, that is making some of the biggest sort of military-type games. Black Hawk Down's one of them. What do you say, Mr. Manzano? Do you think there's a connection between the thrill of, you know, chasing people through a field and killing them on a videotape and having that surge of violence ever come up within you otherwise?
Well, I got to be honest.
Okay.
I see more of a connection personally in saying that people who enjoy more, I can't think of a better term than violent forms of entertainment, are going to be drawn to more violent games, violent shows and stuff. I don't know that it's necessarily a correlation with that instills that, you know, that interest in more violent media in you. It could very well be the other way around. One thing I have to say is working at a company that does military games, that has done military games in the past that have been used by the military to work as a unit communication tools to help, you know, officers and soldiers communicate better in battletime situations. I don't end up playing a game and getting these violent tendencies for it. It's a release for me. I am also an avid paintballer and target shooter, and that's something that I managed to pick up just completely aside from video games. And I don't think that my experience with video games makes me more proficient, you know, with target shooting, with, you know, team-based sports, stuff like that. They're really two separate entities for me. The kind of exhilaration and frustration that I'll feel in one activity to the other. They're very much independent of each other from my experience.
Okay. And I want to finish up today with J.C. Hertz, who's the author of a book called Joystick Nation. Let's do a big wrap-up here, can we, Ms. Hertz? And,
sure.
And that is, we're probably delving deeper and deeper into this world, aren't we? If we sat down 20 years from now, where would we be?
Well, I think we have to compare where we are now against where movies were in the 1940s, which is clearly here to stay, rising industry, bigger and bigger part of culture, and, you know, this is what games are now. They're the art form of the 21st century, for better or worse.
You know what, if you don't mind, I think we're just going to finish on that. That's a pretty perfect phrase, the art form of the 21st century. We thank you for all your comments and input today. J.C. Hertz, author of Joystick Nation. Sean Manzano with us as well from NovaLogic, Dr. Marissa Hecht-Orzac from Harvard Medical School, and Professor Peter Vorderer from the University of Southern California. On Reporter's Notebook in just a minute, in the reconstruction of Iraq, U.S. government reports show that billions of dollars have been lost to corruption or have just plain been wasted. December has been the worst month so far in terms of attacks on Iraqis working on U.S.-backed reconstruction projects. But the Bush administration still talks about unheralded economic and social progress. In a moment, Warren Olney talks with the Army Corps of Engineers in Iraq on To the Point. We'll be right back with more To the Point from PRI.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Norman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is increasingly turning to Iraqi contractors and engineers to design and complete projects that will restore basic services, including water and sewage. But it's not always easy. The Christian Science Monitor reports that several hundred Iraqi contractors have been killed, and a fifth of American reconstruction money has been spent on security. Nevertheless, the Corps says it's been making more progress than it gets credit for. Colonel Bjarne Iverson is director of the National Reconstruction Operations Center in Baghdad. And, Colonel, we're delighted to have you with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be with you this evening. Thank you.
We hear a lot of bad news. What's the good news?
Well, the good news is that Iraqis are increasingly taking charge of the reconstruction effort. The Corps' employee pool itself has grown to about 250 professionals, whether they're managers or information technology managers and engineers, safety personnel, and we are helping them to develop the capacity to inspect, to design, to manage the reconstruction that is ongoing in the country right now. And in addition to that, a vastly larger number of Iraqi contractors are now doing the work of reconstruction in the country. 44% of the contracts right now are being executed by Iraqi contractors, Iraqi-owned businesses, Iraqi engineers, laborers, masons, skilled craftsmen, and so on. And that is increasing every day, as a matter of fact. Fully 77% of the construction effort is in Iraqi hands now, and they're doing a wonderful job. They have taken responsibility for it. You know, it's their country. They believe in what they're doing. They want to take responsibility for it, and it's very rewarding to see and to experience.
How difficult is it for them, given the security issues and the problems others have had with a high level of attrition in the past, to get them to volunteer to do this?
Well, increasingly, even in the areas where there is trouble, we see Iraqi companies coming to the fore and taking the contracts and doing the work themselves. And they are providing their own security. They are working in their own communities. Their own communities are increasingly supporting what they're doing. And there are casualties. We hear reports every day of intimidation, of attacks on construction sites, attacks on workers. But I'll tell you, they are amazing people. They are staying with it. They will not be deterred. It's just like during the election when all the traffic was slowed to a halt, and people walked to the polls. They are determined to get things right in their country and to bring it to the future and bring it up as they know they should. So it's really a pleasure to be a part of. Now, it's not all rosy, as I said. You know, there are significant problems, but those are confined, really, I would say, to probably 4 of the 18 provinces of Iraq. And most of those are in the west or in the center, north center of the country, and they're mostly Sunni-dominated areas. But their efforts to participate in the reconstruction effort are growing, just as their efforts to participate in the elections on the 15th of December grew. And I think that we are making a turn. We're turning a corner in our approach here in Iraq.
Again, Colonel Bjarne Iverson is director of the National Reconstruction Operations Center, and he's speaking to us from Baghdad. There have been reports that some of the big infrastructure projects, particularly in the oil industry, have had to be, if not shut down, that at least it's been very difficult to make progress, and that consequently there's been a focus on smaller projects, schools, police stations, things of that kind. Is that true?
Well, not exactly. In fact, the Corps of Engineers has a two-pronged approach to our efforts in Iraq. The first of those prongs is the national-level infrastructure, which is the focus on electricity, on water treatment plants, on the oil infrastructure, facilities and transportation at the national level. That was by design, and that is going fairly well. The other prong of our approach is those projects which are local in nature, which provide immediate relief and tangible progress in the provincial areas, out in the towns, whether it's building a school or a clinic or digging a well or providing electricity or power generation to a village that hasn't had it in the past. So, in fact, there are that two-pronged approach. And in the beginning, I'll go back a little bit. In the 2 years ago, the focus was the large infrastructure projects, and it's possible and that we probably maybe approached it a little bit, wrong, in my opinion. But we have corrected that over time and have developed a two-prong approach, which in fact covers both the national level and the local level requirements or needs.
Again, we're talking with Colonel Bjarne Iverson at the National Reconstruction Operations Center. How long have you been there yourself, and what kind of a personal experience has this been for you?
Well, this is my second tour. I was here from April 03 to July 04 in two capacities. I was a combat engineer battalion commander in the 1st Armored Division and operated in northwest Baghdad. And then when I changed command here in the summer of 2003, I was a political military advisor for General Sanchez. That was 15 months worth of effort here. And then I returned in July to work with the Corps of Engineers. And I dual track as a foreign area officer and an Army engineer. And coming back in July and having been here 5 months now, in this one-year tour, has been, number one, it's a rewarding experience, but my optimism has grown since I arrived. Number one, with our progress in project delivery, whether at the provincial level or the national level, our progress toward training Iraqi security forces. I see this every day, and I pay attention to it. And I'll be the first to admit, for every 3 steps we take forward, sometimes we take 1 back. But it is progress all the same, and it is steady, designed, steady progress that I think that will, in the long term, pay great dividends for the United States and the Middle East.
Do you think that the new government that will be formed as a result of the election is going to be able to hold the country together? We've heard a lot about possible sectarianism in the future.
Well, this is really, to be honest with you, this is where the hard part begins for the Iraqis. They have to look at the election results. They have to build coalitions. They have to relook their constitution and possibly amend it. They have to take, and they understand this more than we do. It is incumbent on them to take the process forward at the point of a pen and not the point of a gun. And ultimately, they have to reconcile their differences among themselves. I think that they are making good progress at that. The leaders that I am aware of in the Iraqi government are totally focused on that, and their efforts are toward that goal. And there is, obviously, there are issues there that are as yet unaddressed, but they recognize what they are, and they recognize that for Iraq to survive, they have to come to agreements, and they have to reconcile those differences.
Colonel Bjarne Iverson, we're very happy to have had you on our program. Thanks so much for joining us, and good luck on what you're doing.
Well, thank you very much.
Perspective on Iraq from the director of the National Reconstruction Operations Center in Baghdad.
That was Warren Olney speaking with Colonel Bjarne Iverson, who's with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Iraq. Today's program was produced by Andrea Brody with Jonah King and Karen Radziner. The technical director is John Patrick Costello. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Diana Nyad. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW, Santa Monica, and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.